Hey, welcome in. It's your boy, Doug Gottlieb. You are listening to All Ball, the All Basketball Podcast. Dave Pilipovich is our guest this week. Fantastic story and storyteller as we go from Pittsburgh, PA to the Air Force Academy and to infinity and beyond. Oh, I did, in fact, go there. All right, let me give you a couple topics before we hop into our interview with Dave Pilipovich. First thing is, and I've heard this from a couple NBA people, you know, there are guys in the NBA, and I won't name names because that's not fun. It's more fun for you to guess. There are players that play to their stats, and they want their stats to be so gaudy that they are all-stars. And so you start to wonder, hey, what is the line that we can cut off for a player to be an all-star? Because, you know, empty points are empty points. Like, you put up 30 a night, but if your team sucks, what does it actually matter? So I'm not going to pick – there are guys you watch who can load up on the assist by holding it for an extra dribble or two dribbles, that can score at dead points in the game that don't really affect the game but can help their plus minus as well and help their overall point total. I almost wonder if for the NBA, and I'm not a big NBA All-Star Game guy, like I can't remember the last time I watched the NBA All-Star Game, but it's the significance of it within the league. Are you going to reward somebody for just playing for stats? Are you going to reward somebody who attains stats while getting wins? That would be the big challenge to me if I was voting for the All-Star game. As for the NBA, it's really interesting in watching Kawhi Leonard go for 43 in less than 30 minutes. That guy's the best player in the NBA. If you haven't come around to it, you haven't been watching how he competes at the top level of the NBA. Does that mean they're going to win the Western Conference and win an NBA championship or compete? I don't know. Everything has to go right. And for the Clippers, generally, everything goes wrong. On the other hand, if it comes down to Kawhi versus LeBron at this point in their career, I'm going to take Kawhi Leonard. He's younger. He is incredibly efficient. He's been to those big spots before. He's been down before, and he's come back before. Not that you couldn't say the same thing about LeBron, but he is 34 years old. In regards to college basketball, it continues to be a turnstile at the top. But I'm fascinated by some of these teams' offensive droughts. We saw Michigan State. We've seen Oklahoma State scored 101 points in their last five halves of basketball. You do the math on how bad that is. West Virginia's held their last three opponents below 50 points. They're guarding people. I think it's a combination of the fact that they're just the talent's too spread out, and there's not great talent at the top. The game has gotten back to being more physical. I think you're moving back to the three-point shot, I think really affects a three-point shot. Because guys aren't line huggers. They're shooting that ball at an NBA distance, and they're not NBA shooters. And it gets, I know the numbers dipped down and then came back up and then moved back last time, but now you've moved it what feels like a more substantial portion back. And I think that's a big cause for why scoring is down. All right, let's get to our interview on this podcast. It's Dave Pilipovich. He's the head coach of the Air Force.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
All right, so we welcome in. He's the head coach of the Air Force Academy. He's Dave Pilipovich. And coach, I want to go back to the beginning, to the very beginning, not birth, but to the beginning. Your first memory of basketball is what?
You know, being a youngster in a small town in Pittsburgh, watching our high school team play.
What high school?
Probably Duquesne High School, which is closed now. I was probably 6 years old, and my dad took me to the game, and I thought they were the best players around. And I thought the atmosphere and the excitement and watching them play was unbelievable and caught me at an early age.
What was your dad like?
Hard worker, Pittsburgh town, high school education, but owned a bar and little restaurant for 35 years and worked 7 days a week. Steel Town Bar. The steel, you can come outside the bar and turn left and you see the blast furnace. So the guys were in at 7 in the morning drinking a shot and a beer and in at 2 in the morning drinking a shot and a beer. And we lived above it in an apartment probably 700 square feet at the most, and that's where I was born and raised and loved the Steelers, the Pirates, the Penguins, and back in the day, the ABA, the Pittsburgh Pipers and Condors, knew a little bit about them and grew up that way. And I knew I didn't want to work and own the bar because you worked too hard. 7 days a week, you worked every day.
And that's, okay, so how did, how did you get drawn? Because, you know, Western Pennsylvania is a football area, right?
And
like your childhood is the golden era of Pittsburgh sports, as you point out, right? You had the We Are Family, Pittsburgh Pirates. You had the Steel Curtain. Why basketball?
You know, basketball, I was a skinny little kid, slow, and couldn't guard a shot glass, right? So I could make a few shots. So I played, you know, from seven and 8 year old on up, some local teams, and then junior high and all that. And I just loved basketball. And then high school, I was a Division III recruit and went to committed to Bethany College in West Virginia. And the coach left in May and went to Mount Union. Offered me the chance to go to Mountain Union, but I didn't visit, so I went to Teal College, which was not a basketball hotbed, poor program. But I was there, and I played for three coaches of 4 years.
Dang.
But my sophomore year, we had a coach by the name of Mike Griffin, who just came from Colgate University, and he coached us for 1 year, and he just really made an impact on me because I wasn't a great student, didn't want to study, just wanted to watch ESPN and go shoot ball, and that was it. And so he got me to where I could do better in school, and he made an impact on me. And I said, if I can do that to someone else, I want to do that. And as I graduated, I probably wrote to every college coach in the country for a GA position. I got one at a Division II school in Pennsylvania, and there
okay,
it started.
Okay, wait, your speed. We got time here. Okay, so Teal College is an evangelical college, right?
Lutheran school.
Okay, so it's a Lutheran school. So, okay, and it's in what, Greenville? So I don't know. Okay, so I don't know where that is in relation to Pittsburgh. How far?
2 hours north of Pittsburgh, at the most.
What was that? What's that like? You go from, like, you're in Steeltown, you live above a bar, to this really quiet, peaceful, private Lutheran college. What do you remember about that transition?
You know, we lived above a bar, so at night you heard the sirens of the police and a fire truck, or maybe someone had too much to drink, throw a bottle against the building or so, and just noise. You always had noise and action. I get up there, and it's quiet. There's some farmland. Kids from different areas, because I was an inner-city kid. So it was a culture change at first. And then, you know, Division III program, you go, and you think you're the recruit, and you go, and there's 25 kids. At the first workout, 25 guys for the first workout. Say, holy crap! You know, where's this going? And but it worked out. It worked out. I met my wife there, so that's probably the best thing that happened.
Why three coaches in 4 years?
Well, the first coach we had, and it's a funny story. First coach we had, he was there for a while, and he was coaching the golf team, assistant SID, and coaching basketball. And something happened when he and the AD got a little sideways. So he was also the tennis coach. Listen to this. So. At the end of the year, he's still employed, and then maybe 2 weeks after the season, they told him they weren't going to bring him back, but he's still the tennis coach. Well, he only had five players on the tennis team, and he says, do you play tennis? And I said, well, you know, I hit it around. He goes, we have a match at Walsh College, which the head basketball coach was Bob Huggins at the time. He said, we have a match tomorrow. Can you go? I said, do I miss school? He said, yeah. I said, I'll be there. So we go. We play a tennis match. That was terrible. He spent the whole day with Coach Huggins in his office looking for a job opportunity. After the match, you know, you go, what, $6 to go to Burger King? And I'm sitting in the front row of the van, and he says, where do you guys want to eat? And I said, well, let's go to Ponderosa. You know, back in the day, Ponderosa, that was the big thing, right? He goes, we don't have that in a budget. And I swear to you, I looked at him, and I said, Coach, what are they going to do, fire you? And I thought he was going to take a swing at me. And he looked at me and he said, you're right, we're going to Ponderosa.
What's his name?
Excuse me?
What was his name?
Jim Borchick. He was from Barberton, Ohio, basketball hotbed in high school. He went back and became a very successful high school coach in that area. But he was at Teal College for a time. I think he came from Marietta prior to that.
Wow. Okay, so then your second coach was the one who had an impact on you. What was his name?
Mike Griffin. He came from Colgate, and at the time he was at Colgate, he had the leading scorer in the country. I can't think of his name, a guard about 6 foot who led the country in scoring. And he was not renewed at Colgate, so he takes the job at Teal, and we were bad. I mean, we were 4-18 that year, maybe somewhere around there, but he was really good. I started a couple games. He just was, be at practice on time, do the right things, go to class. I mean, he was doing all the right things and made an impact on me. So we had some kids from Cleveland that weren't doing the right things, and he disciplined them. That's how I got to start a few games, because when somebody got suspended, I got to start. But at the end of the year, he got the opportunity to go to RPI, Rensselaer Polytech Institute, Division III in Troy, New York. And he went there, and he ended up lasting maybe 30-some years coaching there.
And then who was your next coach?
Robert Posey Rhodes, who just passed away 2 years ago, was a great player, good player at Wake Forest. Played back in the day at Wake Forest, about 6'6", can really score, skinny guy, funny, rub a snuff in during the games, and he coached my junior, senior year, and I was captain my senior year.
How good were you guys?
We came from 3 wins my freshman year, 3 coaches, and, you know, those 26 guys, only myself and another freshman stayed through our senior years. And then our senior year, we played for the conference championship last game of the year against Hiram College in Ohio, and we got beat. So we made progress.
All right, so you get done, you write all these letters. You wanted to coach. So what was the how did you get your first job?
Well, I got it at a Division II school, California University of Pennsylvania, about an hour from Pittsburgh, a Division II school, and knew somebody who was a GA prior to that who put a good word in for me, and I worked the old Metro Index camp, which was big in the East. 5-star was obviously the king, and then Metro was probably second at the time. And I worked those camps in the summer, got to know the coach a little bit, Tim Loomis, and I was working the camp in July. I still didn't have anything, and after one day at camp, he said, "You want the job?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "All right, it's yours." And that was it. And the camp counselor that year, that game, those years, it was Tom Crean. He was a GA at Central Michigan. He was working the camp. It was Jeff Van Gundy, was a GA at Providence. Herb Sendick, who was at Providence with Patino. And Rob Kennedy, who ended up now runs the Hoop Group. He was at Columbia as an assistant. We used to play pickup. You know, we put the campers to bed, we'd play pickup at night.
Wow, that is a small world. Okay, so what was it like coaching at California University in Pennsylvania?
Oh my! You know, you did everything. You know, they had one full time. They didn't have a full time assistant. Excuse me, that year. The next year they did. So you were basically a full time assistant. So you recruited, and you know, as a young guy, you want to recruit, sign everybody. You want to sign top 5 kids in the country, right? And you realize you can't. So check study halls, get the kids to class, drive the vans, wash the uniform. You know, you did all that. Sweep the court. So I'm there. We start, and it's September, and I'm going on my first recruiting trip. La Plata, Maryland, to go see a kid play, and I tell Coach Loomis, "I'm leaving, I'll be back, blah, blah." He goes, "Well, I won't see you when I'm back." And I said, "Well, what do you mean you won't see me?" He goes, "I just took a job at Bruce Parkhill, Penn State. I'm leaving." That's how he was. I said, "You're what?" He goes, "Don't worry, you're good. 2-year GA position, you're fine." He goes, "I'll call you on Sunday." And he left. He went to Penn State. It was an assistant Bruce Parkhill. And about a 3-week process, they hired Jim Boone. He was an assistant at Baptist College. It was Baptist back then. Now it's Charleston Southern. And he came in, and we developed a great relationship and had a nice little run there for 2 years, and I got hired as a full-time, stayed one more year.
And then where?
Then Tim Loomis leaves Penn State and takes the head job at Florida Atlantic. They were just started the program the year prior and had a coach for 1 year, Lonnie Williams. So for some reason, he left after 1 year. Tim takes the job on the promised that they're going to go Division I, which we did. So we were Division II for 2 years, and then Division I, and he offered me the head job at Florida, the assistant job at Florida Atlantic. And I thought I was in the big time. I was going to make 14-5 and live in Boca Raton, Florida.
What was that like?
And no health benefits. And no health benefits.
No health benefits. That's crazy. So you go to Florida Atlantic in 1989. What do you remember about showing up there? Because you were assistant head coach there, too. He made some big promises.
You know, beautiful place. Will Chamberlain had a restaurant there. You would see him around town. He would play tennis on our campus with our tennis players. So he was around. You know, Boca's just beautiful. The homes, the mansions, the gated communities. And here I come from living above a bar in a bunk bed till I was 21 years old to living in Boca. And was dating my wife at the time, and I said, "Hey, we need more money for me to live down here. Why don't we push up our wedding? We're engaged, get married." So we got married in November, and she came down, and she worked in the banking industry and made a little bit more money than me and got benefits. So we made it work.
How was your teams?
You know, we won 21 and 20 games the 2 years we were Division II, and then we went Division I, and we would play 12 to 14 guarantee games a year.
Oh.
And just for money, just to, for the golf team to get new golf balls and baseball. They didn't have football back then. So it was murder. It was murder there for a while. We would play West Virginia one night, then go to Pitt, and then bust down to Louisiana and play Tulane. And the Boris game, I think we played Memphis back when they were Memphis State and Penny Hardaway, and we got beat, I think, by 56. And but our second year's Division I program, we were 0-21. Finally beat Stetson University up in DeLand because we were moving into the Transamerica Conference back in that day. Beat Stetson, and then two nights later, we go to NC State, and Les Robinson was a coach there. They were about 16-15 that year somewhere, just about the middle of the, 500. And we go to NC State, we're down 21 at halftime, and we upset them by two, and we win that game. So, we finished that year 2-25, I think, but with a win at an ACC school.
What is that like to coach a team that's 2-25? Like, how do you handle that? How do you handle the emotions of losing? How do you handle you're newly married, the kids? Like, you learn. I mean, like, listen, what is it? You're either winning or you're learning, right? You learned a lot. Yeah. What do you learn most?
We had kids from all over. We had a former Navy SEAL who was 27 years old. We had a couple of guys from the Bahamas who said they were 24. They may have been 34. We had six junior college kids. We had a couple transfers, but great group and worked hard. But it was tough, because you're going out and you're playing the money, the guarantee. We're at Auburn. We're at Memphis. We're at West Virginia. We're at Duquesne. We were at Iowa State. You name it. USC. I mean, we were everywhere. Coach Ravling brought the USC team and played us actually in Florida at West Palm Beach at the convention center, which was nice of him to do that. But it was a struggle, You're playing at the end of practice. You're putting clock on the time on the clock and playing a game just so you can get a winner. Just so a couple of the guys can feel good. But to their credit, they were older, they were more mature, and it was a great place to live and go to campus, to be on campus there. So that part helped out. If we were cold and it was 20 degrees and freezing and snow and all that, it could have been a lot rougher. But coming out of the gym and maybe losing 72 degrees in the palm trees, that helped.
Okay, so then you went to what, Georgia State?
Georgia State, yeah, because we had our son Kyle in Florida. And, I was raised, my parents worked, but they worked at the bar. We lived right there. Kelly, my wife, her parents, her mom was home. So we wanted, because you're not home, as you know, as a college coach, you're never home. So we took her off the payroll, and she stayed home to take care of Kyle. By that time, I was making 19.5. I got a big raise. But we wanted to have another child, which we ended up having our daughter in Georgia. So I said, I got to get a job because I still don't have medical benefits. So I got the job at Georgia State as an assistant for $30,000 and full medical, and that was big time. And so then we had our second child, Kelsey, down in Georgia, and it worked out.
Who'd you work for at Georgia State?
Carter Wilson, one of the greatest guys I've ever been around. He was an assistant. He was a longtime high school coach at Decatur High School in Georgia. They were usually top 25, one of the top five teams in USA Today. He took over for Bob Reinhart, who was an NBA guy with the Hawks organization. He was at Georgia State. Carter took over. I was with Carter for 2 years there, and then the opportunity came. Jim Boone stayed in California after I left. Was very successful, Division II. Got the Division I job in Pittsburgh at Robert Morris. Offered us an opportunity to come back home and be back with grandparents and all that, and it was too hard to pass up, so we moved back to Pittsburgh for a while.
All right, so you come back, and now you're in Pittsburgh, where you grew up. 1996. You're at Bobby Moe. What was the program?
Bobby Moe. Program was down a little bit. Jared Dorham was there and was successful. Went to the NCAA tournament a few times, and they had some good programs at Rob Morrison, but it hit the some tough times. They made a change, and Jim was brought in because he was in the area, ultra-successful Division II, couple Final Fours. But it was facilities weren't great, budgets weren't great. You're in a Northeast Conference. But it was a chance that he wanted to be a Division I coach and to be in the same recruiting area where he was. And we were happy to go home. But at the time, I was making now 36 at Georgia State, and I didn't tell Kelly I took the job at Robert Morris for 30. And so we got there and got our first paycheck. She goes, what are we doing? I said, well, we're not going to make as much as we used to, but we're home.
How'd she take that?
She said, here we go. But we were bad the first year. I think we were 3-26. And then we got some better recruits if we took an LSU transfer, a kid out of Beckley, West Virginia, by the name of Gene Neighbors. And Gene led us to, in 4 years, he led us from three wins to the conference championship game his senior year against Central Connecticut State that year. And they beat us, obviously, in the championship. And then we moved on to Eastern Michigan after that.
Okay, wait. You're like, you do this thing in fast forward, okay? So
yeah.
How do you go from three wins? Like, what is the process like? Because that building is really, really difficult, right?
It's
just really, really difficult, and it's more than just getting one transfer. You come in, you're at home, and you're trying to make it work. What was the? Because I'm looking at your stats from 1996, 90. Jim Boone, the head coach, you're 4-23 your first year.
4-23, yeah.
Right?
4-23.
Second year, you're 8-19. Keith Jones and is it Niall Phelan is your two leading scorers?
Yeah.
Right?
Irish kid.
And then you win eight, right? Your third year, you add in Gene Neighbors to Keith Jones and Kevin Covert. And now you finish 15-12, and then... your fourth year, you're 18-12. What do you remember about the pro? Like, what kind of coach was Jim Boone? What did he run? What was his philosophy?
Yeah, very, very good man-to-man defensive coach. Pack line defense, so he gapped everything, didn't pressure the ball, really good help defenders, and a motion team. Really spread the floor, four guys out, single post, a lot of screening, a lot of back screening, down screening. A lot like the Indiana teams when Alford played. With Coach Knight. You know, we would go to Indiana every year and watch practice and watch film, and ran a lot of Coach Bennett's defensive stuff when he was coaching back in Wisconsin back then, and then a lot of Bob Knight's motion. But we got some better players. You know, Gene being a transfer from LSU, Covert was a transfer from Akron, Chris Hopkins, a 6'9", JUCO transfer out of Santa Fe Community College in Florida, and we added the City League Player of the Year from Pittsburgh, Neron Jackson, 6'5", ball-handling guard. So we had some good players, too, that helped us get better in that league.
Okay, so then you go to Eastern Michigan. That's in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Yeah. But, you ever been there?
I have. I actually, ABCD camp was there in the mid-90s. In the mid 90s,
Ben Braun did a great job at Eastern Michigan.
He did do a great job. When you showed up there, what was it like?
Gosh, it was. we have Antonio Gates. Okay, going to be a Hall of Fame former tight end with the Chargers, right? Hall of Famer. So Antonio Gates is on our team. He was the state player of the year in football in Michigan. Goes to Michigan State. Play football for Coach Saban, who is academically ineligible. He's a partial, prop at that time, the term was used. So he sits out. He leaves Michigan State to come play basketball at Eastern. So he's there at that coaching change. He didn't play yet. So we inherit Antonio, and he's practicing with us in the spring. And our football coach at the time, who was newly hired, says, this kid's going to play on Sundays in football. And come on, is he that good? So we really never get to coach him because academically there were some things he just wasn't strong right there that semester, and he decides to go out west to a JUCO to play basketball. Then the story goes, goes to Kent State and play basketball, leads up to an Elite Eight, and then the rest is history, which is funny, though. He worked camp for us that year. He was still with us, and I'm pretty sure we paid him. I'm pretty sure we paid him his camp fee. But through a mutual friend out in L.A., years later, he's playing for the Chargers, where he runs into him, and he said, they mentioned my name, and he said, you tell him he still owes me my camp check.
Paid him?
We paid him. He was joking. I said, you tell Antonio he owes me an autographed jersey. And I swear to you, probably about 6-7 days later, I get a FedEx package here, and I got a San Diego Chargers autograph, 85, hanging up in my office, signed by Antonio Gates.
So you're 1-17 in league, 3-25, and you're like, oh shit, what did we do? Right. You're at home in Pittsburgh, and now you're in Ypsilanti, Michigan. How do you go about trying to fix it?
You know, it was hard. You know, Eastern didn't have a great academic reputation. And Eastern Michigan is on the same Washtenaw Boulevard, same road as the University of Michigan. You run the Big House and Chrysler Center into the Convocation Center at Eastern on the same road, 5 miles apart. So your fan base is all Michigan. You know, even if Michigan's away at Purdue and you're playing Western at home, they're going to stay home and watch Michigan on TV. So it was hard to draw people. The new Convocation Center was a couple miles away from the middle of campus. When Coach Brown was there, they played at the old place right in the middle of campus, and he had it rolling, had some great players, that Sweet 16 run he had. It was hard to get it going. The MAC is a really good league. I kind of take it as, you know, everybody's close to each other, about 2 hours apart. Some schools are 30 minutes apart, Bowling Green and Toledo. But you're all trying to stay, you're all in the same neighborhood trying to date the same girl, you know, so you're all recruiting the same players. And we just never really got over the hump there. It was a hard sell, but we were there, I think, 5 years. Yeah, 5 years.
Doug Gottlieb and Dave Pilipovich is joining us. Hard 5 years.
But the best part, you know, I could talk to your dad quite a bit during that time.
What do you remember? Like, because I'll tell you from the other end what it was like. Okay,
yep.
At this time, you know, I'm done playing in college and I'm playing overseas, whatever. And whenever I'm around my dad, you know, he's calling coaches like you. I got a guy, you know, and all of his guys who were available are better than anybody in your program. Right.
Right.
Right. Which is like, well, why are they still available, Bob? But, you know, like, okay. So like, let's take Marcus Austin was a good player for you, right? Kid from White Plains.
Yep. White Plains, New York. Yeah.
What do you remember about the recruiting process of a Marcus Austin?
Well, I was recruiting Marcus, Robert Morris. He was at White Plains. Spencer, his high school coach, was a part-time scout with Utah Jazz and close with Jeff Van Gundy. Met him at a clinic, at White Plains, New York. And so Marcus was 6'5", just long arms, just built, looked like a basketball player. Shoot the ball extremely well. And sold him on the fact to come to Eastern. He was recruited by some of the other MAC, the Siennas, the Ionas, that type. But get him out of New York, come to Eastern, play in that facility. And back then, you had some pros. You know, you had the Bonzi Wellses who came out of the MAC. You had, what's his name, from OU, whose son's playing now in the NBA. I'm blank right now. But you had some really good players coming out of the MAC who went on to play in the NBA. So we sold him on that. He came. He had a good visit there. The facility was really good. We had a practice gym at the time, which not a lot of people had. So it looked good, and we sold him to come. And Marcus
Brandon Hunter, by the way. Are you talking about Brandon Hunter?
Yeah.
From OU?
Brandon Hunter, yeah. Yep. And so the MAC, you know, the MAC had some great coaches back in the day. You know, you had Jim Buckley, who was at Ball State, who had that run in Hawaii, who beat Kansas and Duke consecutive days or so. And then you had Dockich at Bowling Green. You had Jay Smith at Central. You had Larry Hunter and Charlie Coles at Miami and OU. Dan Hipsher, who did a great job at Akron. I mean, there were some really good coaches in that league. Old school coaches.
Yeah, old school coaches is right, right?
Yeah.
So, again, like, this is the – what are the – because you guys did get better, you know? Like,
yeah,
you didn't get
– we got better.
Yeah, I mean, you went from terrible to solid, and then obviously the last year, when you know you're in the fifth year of a 5 year run, and you're struggling in a really good league.
Yeah.
Like, are you already looking for the next job? Like, what is it? And you also, my brother's has been in kind of this. You hadn't been a head coach yet, so it's not like you can. Hey, I got head coaching experience. What are the conversations like between you and your wife?
Yeah, and at that time, you know, that last year, we started out, I believe, 10-3. We had a post player out of Chicago by the name of John Bowler, who really became a good player at Eastern Michigan.
Yeah, 6'8", junior, averaged 13 and 6 by the end of the year. What did he get, hurt? Is that what happened?
Yeah, herniated his disc in his back, so he was done. And then we went downhill after that because he was the heart and soul of us and really tough. He's assistant now at Wisconsin-Milwaukee, or University of Milwaukee. He's an assistant there now. But it was a really good player for us. We recruited him. Going back a little, recruited him and got him basically to almost commit on September 10th. The next day, I drove to Muncie, Indiana to recruit a kid and woke up in a Marriott there and was on the treadmill and the TV's on, and that was when the towers were hit. But I'll never forget that. I was at Bowler's house the night before, And then we brought him on a campus a few weeks later. They drove over and he committed. But you always ask where you are, you know, the 10th or 11th, especially on the 11th. I was in Chicago at Bowler on the 10th and 11th in Muncie recruiting when our world changed. But, yeah, so we had conversations with my wife, and I always wanted to be a Division III head coach. There's a ton of Division III schools in Pennsylvania and Ohio. I thought it would be a great thing to be a coach and raise your family and be home and not the recruiting that's crazy at the Division I level. And I applied for some Division III jobs, and a lot of times, you know, get through the interviews, and the answer was we didn't want a Division I assistant. We wanted somebody came up, and I said, well, I played Division III. I started Division II. But no, you're a Division I assistant, and you'll leave right away. And I was upset by that because I didn't get some opportunities. So then you're wondering, what's next? You know, where do you go next? And developing a relationship with the Michigan staff, because we were right there down the road. We played them. And then when things didn't keep us at Eastern, I was able to just move down the road and take part in Tommy Amaker's staff at Michigan.
So it's interesting because, you know, Jim was somebody that you had known for a long time, right? I mean, back to the Pittsburgh days, you'd work with him at Robert Morris, you work with him at Eastern. So that's like 9 years working with the same guy. Yeah. So you guys are like, fingers in a hand, or I don't even know, whatever expression you want to. Tommy, you had, you know, obviously sharing the same state, obviously, and that people know that you know ball and you can recruit. But he's a Duke guy. You know, they're different. You show up at Michigan. First, how did he offer you the job? How did that go down?
Well, you know, he had an opening. And it was a operations guy, assistant to the head coach type operations, administrative role the first year I was there. And he had an opening. Somebody moved on, and through a mutual friend and getting to know him. And he calls and says, hey, let's get together and talk. And as you know, Tommy, he's really laid back and casual. And Tommy says, hey, just, you know, don't dress up. Just come over. Let's get together at 4 o'clock Tuesday afternoon. And, you know, I show up in a blue suit with an amazing blue tie, right? And, you know, he said, well, nice touch. I really appreciate that. And I said, well, that's what you do. And we talked for a couple hours, just kind of hit it off. And next day I'm up and at the house on the treadmill, and the phone number comes in. I know it's him, and I get off for quick. And he goes, hey, you ready to be a Wolverine? And I said, yes, I am. So it was awesome, you know, and then got a chance to go. Instead of turning out of the driveway right to go to Eastern, I turned left to go to Ann Arbor, and it was great.
So you didn't move?
No, didn't move, because we lived right in between Ann Arbor. And like you said, they're 5 miles apart. We were right in the middle. So instead of going 2.5 miles one way, I went 2.5 miles the other way.
So, and I would guess you're making more money?
Yes. Making a little bit more money. And,
the greatest deal ever. You go from... And I know that at the time, and I've had long discussions with Tommy about it, you know, at the time they were resource depleted, right? People don't understand Michigan, you know, Michigan was all reputation. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, there's still huge expectations, but you go from no resources, you know, really competitive league with a name that doesn't resonate, to Michigan and Tommy Amaker. So your first year was which season?
It was, gosh, I want to say 04-05.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So 04-05, you do have some good players, right? You have Chris Hunter, you have Courtney Sims, you have Deion Harris. Okay. But it's still, remember, they're still rebuilding from NCAA probation. So, but again, you've worked with one guy for 9 years. I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah.
What was different about Tommy Amaker, his style, his coaching?
He is he's a really good coach. Really good coach, but a better person. He's unbelievable.
Unbelievable guy. Yes.
Because you could have a custodian walk in, and he's in the biggest meeting or film session, whatever, and a custodian will walk in, and he'll say hello to him, you know, or he'll thank him for taking the trash out. He's unbelievable in that regard. Thanks everybody. Appreciates everybody. His preparation was really good. His relationship with the players was above and beyond. I mean, the respect and the discipline, doing it without cussing, cursing, throwing things and all that. He was just, he demanded, and he got the room attention as soon as he walked in. He was really good. I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing how he was. And, it was just a joy to be around. I always tell him I wish it was, because he and I are still close to this day. I wish it was longer. but I learned so much from him. And they're still, to this day, you know, Jim and I are really still close, and the coaches I've worked with. But Tommy, I always tease him that whenever I make an important decision, I always say, what would T.A. do? You know, what would T.A. do? And he goes, come on. I said, no, I always do. And he was unbelievable about that. You know, we're going – that year we started out 6-2 in the Big Ten, and we're ranked 16th in the country. Then we have some injuries, and we go 2-6 on the back end of the Big Ten, finished 8-8, and we're the last team out. So we get the number one seed in the NIT, and we end up going to the championship game where we lose to Ronaldo Balkman and South Carolina. But as we're heading to New York for the Final Four in the NIT, and we're on the charter, getting ready to get on the charter, the families came. Our son Kyle at the time, I believe, maybe had been 7th grade, was a big Duke guy, and J.J. Redick was his guy. And Tommy walks on the plane with a bag, and he throws it at Kyle, and he says, here, but don't open it till we land. And you know, Kyle's nervous. When he opens it, it's an autographed J.J. Redick shirt. You know, to this day, he still has. You know, Kyle's 27 now, works for USA Basketball. He still has the J.J. Redick shirt. But Tommy was just so thoughtful of everybody. Yeah. Made sure everybody was comfortable, everything was in place. And the bigger the game, the better he was in the locker room at pregame. He was really, really good, I thought.
What was it like when he was let go?
You know, we just the second year, and we weren't as good that year. And we and I think there was a story they wrote in Ann Arbor, Coach Beilein. We're beating Ohio State at home. They're number one in the country. And they had that remarkable team with Odin Conley. And I think we're up 6, and we get a dunk at the rim with Courtney Sims, who had a cup of coffee for some teams in the NBA. Sims misses the dunk. And they go on a run, and we lose to Ohio State at home. And you win that game. We're in the NCAA tournament. Everything's fine. You lose that game, and then we win the first game in the Big Ten tournament and lose the second one. And we go to the NIT. We win the first game at home. I think we beat Utah State that year at home. Then we go to Tallahassee and play Florida State, and we lose. And on a Thursday, come home on Friday, you're in the office. Saturday morning, I'm in the shower early. I'll never forget it. Ready to go to the office. My wife hollers in and says, coach is on the phone, and that's never good. I get off. He goes, you know, bad news, Dave. You know, AD brought me in this morning, called me in. I just met him, and he let me go. He goes, can you come in? I said, yeah, I'm on my way. And you know, I felt so bad for him because he didn't deserve it. He said, our locker room leaked. We had to practice in a rec center. Chrysler was terrible. Our offices were a mile away. It was just bad. It wasn't where it is now.
Well, no, I mean, that's the thing is you didn't get to, and I, you know, and talk, and like, look, I would readily admit I was at ESPN at the time, and it was very early in my career at ESPN.
And I'll get back, can I stop you for a second? That ESPN with you and Tom Brennan, that was the best.
You know, I've never talked about this, and I'm glad you brought that up. So what's fascinating about this, and this is where, you know, like I don't know, I struggle sometimes with our business. So I felt like Tom Brennan was an absolute prince. I mean, he's funny. He's affable. He had no ego. Now he was put in a situation which is really hard, where he had coached at one place, I think for 18 years. Okay. Yep. So, and you know this, when you're at Vermont for 18 years, it's not like you know you don't know all the players. You don't know all the not only is a coach at Vermont, but he's also doing a radio show. So when he wasn't coaching, he was doing his radio show, and then he's like the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. So when he got there, you know, like his first couple years, he struggled with like he didn't know all the players. And I've been doing it forever, you know, like as a kid and growing up, and I had only covered really national stuff. At some point, like his whole thing was like, not only did he sometimes not know about every player, but he didn't give a shit, and it worked. And our problem was like our bosses at the time were like, well, Tommy only, I swear to God, this actually happened. I had a boss who came in after a halftime segment, and he said, Doug, you talk for a minute and 42 seconds. Tommy, you talk for 47 seconds. That's not acceptable. And I said, I will not share this gentleman's name because I actually like him. I said, what's your point? He's like, well, you're dominating the conversation. I said, no, I don't actually see it that way. I said, was it good? He's like, well, that's not the point. I go, no, that actually is the point of television is, were you entertained? Yeah. Did you change the channel? It's halftime, right? If I'm watching a game, it goes to halftime. I got to be really fucking entertained or I'm going to change the channel and watch a different game because there's a million games on. I was like, were you entertained? He's like, that's not the point. I go, you're missing the point. Tom's deal was he would say, you know, like Dave Revson was our host and Rever would come in and Rever would say, TB, what, you know, he's got a big game tonight. It's Duke versus, you know, North Carolina. What would you tell your team? And Tommy would say like, I'd tell him, oh, let's go have some fun. We'll go have a steak afterwards. Who gives a shit, right? Like, he would literally say that on TV, and we'd be laughing, and I'd go into some basketball stuff, and it worked. But it's really amazing on how oftentimes I still believe to this day Tom Brennan should have been the Lee Corso of college basketball, and for whatever reason, and, you know, I mean, it broke my heart because they never told him anything and then they didn't renew him. And, you know, I mean, in all candor, I had people tell me, well, you know, you made Tom look bad. Like, no, we played off each other. Like, I was the former player dork who pushed the envelope and he was the old coach who just had a great time. I thought it was real. I appreciate you saying it. I thought it was really good.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great. My wife loved it. Yeah, we used to talk all the time. And I knew Tom a little bit, you know, but I thought it was great. I really did. I was so disappointed when it didn't continue.
Dave, he's as authentic a person, like as a good dude, as you will ever find. And I, listen, and here's just another little quick aside, because I know basketball people listen to this pod. They named the court after him in the old gym. They opened a new arena this year, and his name's not on the court. That's wrong, man. Like, Vermont's not Vermont without Tom Brennan Court. And, you know, like, they're doing a great job there. His name needs to be on the court. So here's what I'll full disclosure. I'm on ESPN. I remember Tom got fired. Tommy got fired. And what I said was, like, look, there's, I don't know, 73 programs at the, you know, Big 12, Big 10, SEC, ACC, and what league am I forgetting? Big East at the time. And they were you guys were one of like two or three that hadn't made the tournament during his time there. And I said, I think, you know, that's really, unfortunately, why Tom lost his job. But in his defense, like, unless you were at Michigan and understood, one, what the sanctions did, and two, like, you don't get to see the new arena. You don't get to see the new practice facility. You don't get to Bennett. Like, you build all this shit up, and then they whack you. And, you know, look, the guy won at Seton Hall, and the guy's won at Harvard, where no one has ever won before. And
but
so if... Right. Amazing. Like, amazing. So just the idea that he wasn't going to turn the corner at Michigan, and Beilein did an amazing job because he's a great coach, right? This isn't an anti-Beilein rant, but it is fascinating on how you get that new arena and they have let the guy at least coach in the new building before you whack him.
You're exactly right. I mean, what he's done at Harvard and brought he's raised the whole level to play in the Ivy League because of that.
The whole league has changed. The whole league has changed because of, and I called their first win ever in the NCAA tournament. It was like amazing. And you win. I mean, obviously, like, it was Laurent Rivard. He played Laurent Rivard at the four, and. Yep. And Steve Alford would play his two bigs, and the four men couldn't go out and cover Rivard. And Rivard hit like four threes, and New Mexico got super, super tight. They were a really good club. And, it wasn't just a win. It was a coaching win. Like, I felt like he coached his way to a win by finding one mismatch on the floor that he was able to exploit.
Yep. You know, and that New Mexico team was really good. They were 12th in the country last Mount West Conference game of the year. We played them here at home, down 16 early, and beat them by two. and we played a kid out of Roswell, New Mexico, came off the bench for us, Mark Olasinski, who was undersized 4 or 5, and we did that. He made 5 threes against them that helped us get back in the game and then eventually beat them, and that was their last regular season game. Then they went on to win the Mountain West tournament, and then, you know, Harvard beats them in the NCAAs with a great win.
How'd you get to Air Force? How'd that happen?
Well, so we get released. They go through the process of what they're doing. They hire Coach Beilein, and he comes in, and I was a member of the staff. He offered me a contract to stay, and we were going to go month to month. And because a couple of his assistants from West Virginia didn't come yet, they were involved in head coaching jobs. And so I said, Coach, I really appreciate it. You know, married, 2 children. I need a job. I said, but all due respect, I'm going to call Coach Amaker, because my loyalty's to him, and see if it's okay with him. And he goes, I respect that. I really do. So I called Coach Amaker. He goes, yeah, Dave, you got to do that. If you could stay on, if I can help you, whatever, you need to do that. So I stayed on with Coach Beilein. We went through some recruiting, did some workouts. I think the thing impressed Coach Beilein, he called me on Easter morning. He was back in West Virginia. You know, he's a big Catholic churchgoer every day. And he called me right before he's going to church. I think it's 6 a.m. And my phone's always on. He calls, I pick up, and he goes, what are you picking up for? I wanted to leave you a message. Happy Easter. And he wanted to run something by me, and I answered it. And he came back. He goes, I appreciate you, you know, picking up. And I said, well, Coach, you got to be on. You know, you got to be on. So we worked together. He was great. He was great. And then I didn't feel like a part of it. You know, when people are coming by the office now and, hey, you're going to turn this thing around. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. You know, the players will say something different too, right, and all that. You kind of feel like that stepchild, right? And if I could have stayed, if I didn't have anything else, I probably would have stayed. But then this job.
That's a hard deal. My brother, this is kind of interesting. About the same time, my brother was at San Diego State for 8 years. I should probably have him on I had to tell this story, he'll be pissed. So he had developed a relationship with Ben Braun, on recruiting trail, and Ben had a relationship with my dad. And so he loved San Diego and San Diego State, and he loved working for Steve Fisher. But people have to remember at the time, Brian Dutcher was Steve Fisher's right-hand man. So was whenever Coach Fisher decided to retire, and Mark Fisher was on the staff. This is before Mark was diagnosed with ALS. And so Greg was like, you know, look, no one at that point had the Mountain West hadn't blown up to the point where guys were getting head coaching jobs. You had to get to the Pac-10, and he had a relationship. He met his wife when he was at Sac State, and she lived in San Francisco. So they always loved Northern California. So Ben Braun had tried to hire him a couple times over. He goes and takes the job, and then 7 months in, they finish in 9th place, and you know, lose on like a crazy tip in at UCLA. And they finish in 9th place with 2 pros at Cal, and the league gets like 7 teams in or something. Anyway, Braun gets fired, and he ended up staying with Mike Montgomery being the only guy, and you know, he ran the benefit of Monty didn't come from another program, so he didn't have a list of assistants, and Monty hadn't been recruiting for 4 years, you know, so Greg was a recruiting coordinator. But and then, you know, when Monty retired, Konzo kept him for a couple of months. So I know the feeling of what you're saying, where you're kind of hanging around and you're part of it, but you're not part of it. And especially when you get fired, that everybody who used to be your friend is now coming in saying, you'll be better than the last guy. You're like, wait, I was here when the last guy was there. We weren't bad. Like, say it's a, okay, so how did the Air Force thing take place?
Well, then Jeff Bezdalek leaves and goes to Colorado, leaves the Air Force, goes to Colorado. They go through a long time of hiring, not hiring, and then they end up hiring Jeff Reynolds at the time, who was an assistant here under Bezdalek, but went to Colorado with him, and then they brought him back. I've known Jeff, you know, from back in camp days when he was an assistant at Randolph-Macon back in the 90s. Had some mutual friends and knew him, and we stayed in touch always through the years. You know, you talk to coaches, and he reached out and said he had an opening. He's looking at some guys. Would I be interested? I said yes. Another couple of days, he said, you know, are you still interested? Yes. Another couple of days, we interviewed on the phone. He offered me the job on the phone. I took it. You know, we never lived, you know, this far west. I was out here in 91 for the Final Four when when UNLV beat Duke, and that was the only time I've been in Denver or this area, and came out, and then I said, here we go. So we moved on out, and that's where we've been since.
Okay, so you show, but the Air Force Academy is a different place. I mean, obviously, Colorado Springs is amazing, is beautiful,
yeah.
And it, the whole academy lifestyle is very different. And what people I think forget yeah. about Buzz is, you know, it was Joe Scott who got it going, right? And I remember when Joe Scott first kind of got it going at Air Force before they really won, before you guys won. My brother's like, hey, you know who's going to be good in a couple years is the Air Force, because he's like, look, they actually have good players, and the Princeton stuff works. They're playing in altitude, and you know, everybody else in this league is taking, you know, a lot of chances with transfers, and like they just have good hardworking kids. And I'm telling you, he's like, I bet they make the NCAA tournament a couple years, and
wow.
And this was like very, very early on, and I was covering the league at the time, and then and then Mooney got the job, and it kind of took off. You didn't get there till kind of the tail end of it, right? And part of it was Buzz, as good a coach as Buzz was, a very good coach, he wasn't really a Princeton guy, so he kind of ran some of it, but didn't have the same passion for it, and he didn't have a real passion for recruiting. So I felt like he didn't leave you with the cupboard full. Not that Air Force is an easy place to recruit to anyway. So but then there's the academy. So you show up. What's the first day of work like at the Air Force Academy for a guy who's been small schools, big schools, all in the Midwest?
You know, you come through the gate. First of all, you've got to show credentials to get through the gate. So they're checking. They pop the trunk and make sure you don't have anything, because you're not on the. You don't have a government card yet, because you're not through the process, so you're as a visitor, and they, you know, and I'm scared of them. I mean, goodness gracious, what are they going to do? And then you drive up to the academy, and it's, you know, you see students walking around in uniforms. They're marching, they're business oriented, because they're going from one class to the next in 7 minutes. Their heads are down. The freshmen can't look at some people or salute, you know, have to salute everybody. They can't walk on the middle of the walkways. They have to walk on the rubble strips on the side. They can't carry their backpack on their back. They got to hold it and run. And they say, what are we doing? What am I getting myself into? And then we have our first team meeting, and they're great guys. They're great guys. They came off that Final Four run in the NIT, but they were all graduating. Jake Birchie led that group. They're all seniors. They're all leaving. So it's the younger guys coming up. And then, okay, workouts tomorrow. When are we going? Morning, late? No, we can't get them till 2:30, and we got them till 4:30, unless it's a military day. And then your schedule, I mean, wow. And then your list of recruits, and you're calling up kids, and they have three Division III offers in you, and then they decide not to even play basketball, but they still won't come to the academy because they don't want to do the military. And I, oh, my gosh. You're just getting nose and nose and nose. And at that time, your dad put me on a kid, 6'7" kid out of California, and I really liked him. He was going to UW-Milwaukee and had a good career, and I can't think of his name right now. And because he called, and we got in touch with him, and he was a tough kid. He could shoot the ball, 6'7", rebounds. And he came to visit, and there's just no way he wanted to do this. And he ended up going to Milwaukee and had a pretty good career there. I can't remember his name, but, you know, we're just missing out on guys. And then the guys we're taking were beating, you know, we're beating, goodness gracious, Texas Tyler. We're beating Cal San Diego, and we'll beat D2s, and everybody else in the league is getting, you know, who they're getting. And I said, oh, my gosh, this thing's not going to be, you know, because when we line up and play, we're not going to have the guys that they have. So it's a difference.
Remind me, so you're there for 4 years, and then did Jeff get fired mid-year? Did he resign mid-year? What happened?
Yeah, the administration came in. We were struggling, winning some games, and, you know, maybe coaching tactics or whatever it may be, someone likes, someone doesn't like, and caught me off guard. So I come in one day, and he's in a meeting in his office across the hall from me, and the AD and assistant AD comes out, and he says, you got a minute? I come in, he goes, I just got fired. I said, what? And then selfish, you know, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, my son's ready to go to college. I got to pay for college. My daughter, you know, I'm thinking, what am I going to do? You know, here I am all the way out here. Not a lot of contacts out this way. And I'm thinking, And he said, they're going to call you upstairs in 15 minutes and name you interim head coach and go do it. And hopefully maybe they'll keep you. And he goes, I apologize, but whatever reason, they're going a different direction. And I said, oh, my gosh. And so it happened. Back then, we had the Mount West Network, you know, and so there was things on TV that day. They interviewed our players, some of our players. We were a little bit fractured there at the time. Guys going different ways. And I said, oh, my gosh. So here we go. And we didn't even practice that day. So just clear your heads. And then our first game was against Boise State that Saturday. That was our bye week. We just got beat at Colorado State the game prior to. And Jeff was ejected late in the game for a second technical. And I don't think that had anything to do with it, but it didn't show well on TV. And actually, my son was a freshman at the time. He was a manager for 10 Miles at Colorado State. So he's in the locker room videotaping the game. They're up 20. 10 Miles sends another manager in to go get Kyle out because I coached the last, 11 minutes of the game so he can be on the floor. And we lose. We're off Sunday. They made that decision on Monday. And then we played Boise that Saturday, got beat. We go to Wyoming the next Wednesday, and Coach Scheidt's the best there is. And we go up there, and we're down 11-0 to start the game. I said to myself, we're going to be the first team that calls basketball that never scores a basket.
Wait. So this is your first game as head coach?
Second game. We lose to Boise the first game.
Okay, but so again, you're doing that thing, okay?
Yeah.
You had coached for 20 years at this point?
Yeah, 20-something,
okay.
20-plus.
So
yeah.
It's your first game as interim head coach, and you're taking on Boise State, good program, well coached, okay?
Yeah.
And so what do you remember, what is that like to have, you waited your whole life and you thought, I'll be a D3 head coach. Now you're the head coach at Air Force Academy in the middle of the year. What do you remember about that first game? About that, that is my the expression I have always, there's no bigger move in the country than the 18 inches from assistant coach to head coach. What was that like?
You know, you're worried about everything. Pre-game meal, warm-up's going to be okay. You know, substitutions. What do I do here? Timeouts. What do I do? You're everything. Your head's spinning. And a game was on. CBS Sports, Coach Lapis had the game, and he walked in the office before the game and said, hey, how you doing? And he talked for about 5-10 minutes. I really respected that. He said, hey, just do what you do. Be who you are. You can't be anybody else, and enjoy it. And he said that because there's only 300 some of these out there right now, and you got one of them. He said, enjoy it. And so we go out there, and we get off to a good start. We got the lead early, 17-12, I remember, and then they take the lead at halftime. In the second half, we were exhausted. Just everything that went on. They were better than us, first and foremost, but then everything that week that transpired, our guys were gassed. And so we end up losing that game, and here we go. Now we got to reset, recharge in here on Sunday.
Okay, wait, you wait your whole professional career for this opportunity. You know, do you remember, what your wife said? Are you thinking, because here's, I'll give you my quick personal. So, I coached AAU basketball, and I've coached in different tournaments. So I coached the Maccabi Games team in Israel.
Yep.
And we do workout, the summer before we do workouts and tryouts. And I feel like, all right, it just felt normal running a practice. And I'd seen my dad doing, I'd seen a million practices. I felt like my offensive philosophy was sound. Defensively, I was a little, how you guard different actions. I was a little, I had more philosophy than seeing it play out. I'll never forget. Yep. We practiced for a couple of days at Fairfield University. Then we fly to Tel Aviv. We practiced for a couple of days, and then we scrimmaged the under 20 national team. And we have some guys a little bit older. We have one 26-year-old kid, one 22, but the rest of, it's age appropriate. But, this is a national team. They play together forever. So we go out there, and I start two big guys because I'm an idiot, and we're down 18-2 to start the game. And I remember sitting there going, and I had interviewed for the Oklahoma State job before that summer, and, I had full confidence that I could hire the people that knew what I didn't know, but it's basketball. You know what you're doing. And I remember thinking to myself, holy shit, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here, right? And I made some adjustments, and we got competitive and whatever, and I felt like by the time I walked out the door that day, I didn't have full confidence that I would win the tournament, but I was like, maybe I don't know as little as I thought when we were down 18-2, but the 18-2 was alarming. I'm wondering, when you walked out of Clune that day and you lost your first game, was there any, holy shit, maybe I can't do this or I can't fix this thing?
Yeah, you have that doubt because of some things that happen in the game, like you're saying, and maybe a lineup blunder you have or a defense assignment you don't do. And you're thinking, I'm thinking to myself, okay, it's a lot harder than you think. You know, sometimes you sit on that other seat and you have all the answers. Hell, you
know. Oh, yeah. I mean, hey, when I'm broadcasting a game, I know everything everybody's supposed to do.
And I said, not only did I not have the answers, I didn't even know the questions. And I said to myself, I'd love to just win one Division I game. That would be awesome. You know, here's a kid who grew up in an apartment above a bar and didn't have a lot, and now I'm coaching at the Air Force Academy, and I never can get in here because I'm not smart enough. And if we can win one game, that would be awesome, you know. And so you keep – and we had a great staff that was together, and you don't want to change a lot, but yet there's some things you may need to tweak, right? And you only have a little bit of time to change it. So then we lose that game, and they said we prepare, and we go up to Laramie to play Wyoming, and they had a pretty good team. And we go up there, and we're down 11-0 to start. So now you're really thinking, goodness gracious, this is bad. And it's on the Mountain Network, and people are watching it. You say, you may not score. We're bad. We may not win a game. We're going to lose these guys. So you call a timeout, and I really said this to the guys, and they come, and they're looking at you, and they're wondering. They want the answer. I said, guys, we're fine. We're fine. Just relax. I said, we got it right where we want them. I said, we're down 11-0. They're going to be overconfident. They're going to start jacking some shots. We're going to get right back in this thing. You know, and I'm wondering, oh, my gosh. And we do. We end up getting back into it, and we end up winning the game. We end up winning the game up there on the road, and we've got one on the road, and we win that game.
In Laramie, 7,000-plus feet, and against Larry Shied, who everybody knows can coach his butt off. Like, yeah. Okay, so what's that? What bus ride back to Denver? Or did you guys fly right out of Laramie? What's that like?
Bus back, and, you know, and I remember walking down to shake his hand after the game, and the first thing I said to him, sorry, you know. And he goes, what are you sorry for? Great job. I'm happy for you. You know, keep doing what you're doing. He's just the best. He's the best there is.
Unbelievable guy.
And we could have walked home. You know, we were so excited. We thought we won a national championship. I mean, we beat Wyoming and haven't won since, you know, 6 weeks before that. And it was just great for the kids, for them to rejoice and take part of that. So now we get home, you know, 3 a.m, and who do we play on Saturday but San Diego State. And I'm looking at the balls on my wall here, and I think at that time they were 21st in the country. And I remember, and they were really good. They were really good with the Franklins and Tapley. I mean, they were good.
Yeah.
And I remember before the game, about an hour and a half before the game, I'm coming out of the coach's locker room just changing, and they're coming in, and Coach Fisher grabs me, and he's the best. And he says, hey, Dave, you know, I'm sorry for everything that happened with Jeff. Are you okay? He said, if there's anything I could ever do to help you, let me know. He goes, you know, I was in your position at one point. I said, yeah, Coach, but you won 6 straight, won the national championship, you know, as an interim coach of Michigan, you know, laughing with him. And he goes, no, if there's anything I could ever do, you know, let me know. And he goes, good luck to you and stay in touch. And I thought that meant a lot coming from him. And we went out there, and Tapley was hurt that game. His wrist was hurting. He wasn't real good. And we just hung around, chucked up some shots, and we ended up upsetting them, you know, and they were, you know, ranked 21st, the highest upset of a ranked team ever in the history of Air Force. So we're 2-1 now. Kids rushed the crowd. I mean, the crowd, we had a decent crowd that game. They jump on the floor. They rushed the floor, and our kids felt happy. We just beat a ranked team, and we're 2-1 now, you know, in my 3 games. So, you know, it's crazy. It's crazy. And we play the next game at home against TCU, and we're up 3 late. Miss a scoring opportunity. They come down, score, go. We go up 1. We come down, don't score our last possession. They hit a shot, the buzzer beat us. We could actually win up 3-1. Went to be 3-1. We were 2-2. And then we didn't win another game the rest of the year. We lose the Mount West games, and we lose first round the Mount West tournament. But prior to going to the Mount West tournament, the administration came down and awarded me with a 3-year contract to stay. And so that was big right there.
What is that feeling like?
You know, now, first thing, okay, we're going to be able to pay for college. My son's at CSU, and so we'll get him through school, and then our daughter's going to be next. So we got 3 years to make this thing right. And just Coach Lapis's words in my mind, at that time there was 351, or 345, I think. He goes, there's 345 of these out there. And if this opened tomorrow, you'd have 2,000 applicants. You know, even exaggerating. But he goes, you got one of the Division I head coaching jobs. Try to enjoy it. And so that was the.
By the way, another there. Prince of a guy. Just another yeah. Like I've worked with him, and yes. I would also say kind of that we had the same thing when I was at CBS. We were doing games together, and yeah. We would like kind of we would verbally kind of spar like back and forth, coach and player, and
yes,
we loved it.
Yes, you would.
And uh-huh. And I had a boss who at the, you know a guy who was like he came to a game in Vegas. He's like, oh, are you guys okay? We're like, what are you talking about? It's like, yeah. Well, you guys were kind of going back and forth. I was like. That's how basketball people are, right? A coach and a player.
Right,
like it was
right.
Beautiful. Yeah.
No, I thought you guys were
and
good.
It wasn't his call. There was one guy back in New York, I'll leave his yep. name out of it, who wasn't comfortable with like he just wanted everybody to wrap their arms around each other and hug each other during the game. Like, all right, but it was real. Anyway, I think Lapis is an absolute prince of a guy. And yep. It's a great way of looking at it, right? Billis has told me the same thing about doing games. You know, everybody gets pissed when they get their games. And you're like, hey, yep. man, you're getting paid to call basketball games. Like, a little perspective yep. here. Like, yeah, you know, you're right, Jay. You're right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get it, but now you have the job that you wanted, but it's a yep. really, really hard job. And it's been hard to yep. get it back to that. To that place where it was, going back 10 years ago, what is, what's the biggest challenge obviously is getting players. Like, do you simply have your staff look for people that are military families? Like, what's the process like of finding a player when you're at Air Force?
Well, it's high academics, so we're Ivy League standards. And then, you know, we lose a lot of kids because of medical reasons. You can't be on any type of medication. And a lot of kids are on ADD medication. And that's a non-go here. So we lost a really good minority player a couple years ago, 6'7", was really skilled. It was had asthma. We lost some ADD. We had lost maybe a minor vision or hearing ailment that was fine anywhere else or whatever it may be. So that's hard. The academics are hard. The part about the medical is hard. And then the commitment, 5 years, mommy, sometimes thinks little Joey's going to go off to war. That's not the case, There are some deployment opportunities in your career field, but there's a lot that aren't. So it's really hard fighting all that. And then what's changed, as in college basketball landscape now, is the transfers. Right. Back in the day where teams would get young again, they're not getting young anymore. They're staying old because of the transfers. And that has been really, the Mountain West has really benefited from that. Muscleman we did in Nevada. New Mexico, what they're doing, transfer, San Diego State, even their backcourt this year. Vegas has done over the year. Everyone, Boise's now loading up. So when you think you can get your guys to juniors and seniors and now you got a chance, well, guess what? Those other teams are going to stay juniors and seniors too now. So that's been probably our hardest obstacle.
You have this kid, Lavelle Scotty, who comes from a really tough background, background in Fort Worth. And now he's like a senior. You talked about your initial, what you wanted to do was be a Division III coach and be a part of kind of the change from boy to man. And you've been able to do that with Lavelle, haven't you?
Yep. And he's one
how has he changed? What has that been like to be his coach and watch him go through this process for the last 4 years?
Lavelle comes from a tough family background where he's kind of the breadwinner of the family. He's taken care of his siblings and his mom and dad over the years while he's been here because they do receive a stipend here. And it's been some rough times with his mom and dad gone through back there, and he's had to go home and take care of them and make sure they're getting what they need. And when he came here, he just didn't fit with some of the other guys who were at the academy, non-athletes too, just because of their background. Some of them are coming from parents or senators or congressmen or doctors, and they went to the academy, and it's that three-car garage kid. And Lavelle. And I just said, if there's one I'm going to bet on, it's not going to make, it's going to be him. But he was determined to make it, and he's extremely bright and made it through the prep school and then came here to the academy. And, like even this year, he didn't go home for Christmas. He didn't go home for Christmas. He was the only player to stay here. And just because it was better for him to be here. And we lose Saturday night, as down in New Mexico, and then you know what happens Saturday night to one of their players. And Sunday I'm sitting in my office here watching film, and he comes by to get some shooting in. And I said, hey, did you hear about, the player in New Mexico? He said, no, I didn't. And I said, Lavelle, I just appreciate you and your teammates of how you guys are and how you represent. And he goes, well, Coach, we can't do those things here. And I said, not only you can't do them, but you wouldn't do them. He goes, no, I won't. He goes, that's not who I am. And, you know, you respect that. And that's the kind of kids you have here. They make better choices. Now, they're going to make some bad choices. Don't get me wrong. You know, we got kids here to make some choices that aren't right because they're still kids. But, you know, I appreciate that. And when he's come through, when he graduates here, I mean, that's a story that unbelievable that he'll graduate and be an officer in the Air Force from what he came from and what he had to go through while he was here. And not really only that, he's been a pretty good player.
He's been a really good player. I got two more for you. First is this. If there's an assistant coach who is struggling right now, you've coached some bad teams, been assistant on bad teams, right? And it feels like, man, maybe I should go into medical sales, you know, maybe I should take a high school job or whatever. What would you say to them to get them kind of mid year when things are bad? What would you say to them from your perspective to keep them going?
You got at this for a reason, and the reason was to help kids and be a part of a team, because that's always what you've done. Continue to work and build that team. Don't look for that next job or think about we're not going to get this done. Keep making that the best job you have. Keep making and working for that head coach who gave you an opportunity to be the best head coach he can be and the best program he can be. And keep doing what you've done all your life, because you've always tried to make the team or be in the starting five. Do whatever, because you've grown up in this sport. Keep doing the right things and good things will happen.
All right, last thing. You do have a senior. You have a couple of really good seniors, and you guys have had some. You guys have had some huge wins. What has to happen for your team to accomplish your potential this year?
We got to stay healthy first and foremost, and then we've got to shoot the basketball at a higher rate than we did. You know, we took some questionable shots and early shots and bad shots on Saturday, 8 of 28 from three. We got to be better from the three. And then we can't turn the ball over at the rate we did in that game, especially, you know, we only had 5 in the second half, but we turned 4 over. We're really crucial. So we've got to shoot it and take better shots at the rate we can, because we're one of the better shooting teams, and protect the ball a little bit better, because we can't give open run. We had 3 bad plays where they got dunks on the other end, 6 yep. points. We lose by 6. There's no defense, as you know, for that. That's, you know, it's a pick 6. So we got a little bit better at that, and because this group really gets along well. We've got, you know, 13 more. You know, we can pick a few here and there, and then maybe we'll have some fun here at the end of the year.
Well, listen, it's always great to catch up. I had no idea you grew up above a bar, but it does give you that perspective of even when you lose a couple in a row, if you consider where you've been and where you've gotten to and this run that you've had at Air Force and the lives that the academy and your program have been able to change, it's really a remarkable thing. Thanks so much for telling me your story and for joining me on the podcast.
Well, I appreciate all you do for our game. Keep doing great things.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
Hey, my thanks to Dave Pilipovich, head coach of Air Force, for that was a fun discussion. Remember, you can download and listen to any of these long-form interviews plus some other thoughts on Hoop with All Ball. Subscribe, rate, download, subscribe, and rate. Download, subscribe, and rate. And make sure you listen to my daily radio show, which covers all sports, but we also have great interviews on that as well. 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, SiriusXM 217 and 203. There you go. Those are all the places that you can find me, or just hit me up on Twitter at Gottlieb Show. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.